or else know nothing of their whereabouts. Throughout the vast expanse of the Russian police state, they managed to lead with astounding ease the typical life of the Bezporoznye, the homeless, jumping goods trains, constantly on the move from town to town, from settlement to settlement. They make a living by stealing and selling goods from government stores, and frequently they steal back what they have just sold, blackmailing unsuspecting purchasers with the threat of laying information against them. They sleep in railway stations, in municipal parks, in tram terminuses. Often all their belongings can be wrapped in a small bundle tied with a leather strap. The easiest situations perhaps were those of the young people called upon to distance themselves from their ancestors and thereby the social class into which they had been born. In order to cast off the circumstances of their birth, explained one Western reporter, it became commonplace for young people to publicly denounce their families and thereby repudiate their bourgeois origins. This was often done with said parents' consent or even at their recommendation. To see these sorts of notices in the press was jarring to the outside world, and with good reason. But even betraying one's own was not enough. In the perverted Soviet system, people who turned in family members were still in a sense connected in perpetuity to those undesirable elements. Fitzpatrick recounts the incident of one communist who informed on his mother-in-law before himself being accused of being related to her. The more antithetical to communist ideology one's ostensible status was, the greater the coup it became to get them to publicly turn against their own. As powerful of a statement as it might be to turn on one's parents, it was that much more impactful to turn on one's God. It was Karl Marx himself who famously wrote that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. Soviet newspapers printed letters to the editor from priests renouncing and denouncing religion. Even more intense were such moments as when worshippers sat in horror while their priest told them that religion was a deceit and that he no longer wanted to be a weapon in the hands of counter-revolutionaries. He then ripped off his vestments and left the church. This was a new society of the future. Instead of God, there was only man, and that man was Joseph Stalin. Chapter 7. Afraid of Anything and Everybody. The year 1933 saw Adolf Hitler come to power in an economically devastated Germany. By that point, Benito Mussolini had been in office in Italy for a decade, and the following year would see Broadway singing his praises. You're the top, you're Harry Houdini, you're the top, you're Mussolini. At the time, Mussolini was regarded as somewhat of a moderate, a fusionist who combined the best elements of socialist Russia and capitalist America to create the third way of fascism. Talk of American Revolution had been in the air since the days of Louis Ling, and this buzz sharply escalated. As newspapers dutifully reported that the Soviet Union was surviving its birthing pains, the Great Depression seemed to prove Marxist predictions of the internal self-contradictions of capitalism correct. It seemed only a matter of time before his other prediction, that of a revolution by the working class, would come true as well. Early in 1932, over 10,000 veterans of the Great War had camped out in Washington, D.C., living in shanties that they had assembled from random junk. Destitute, they demanded that the bonuses due to them in 1945 be made redeemable now. That July, they were ordered to clear out by the police. They rioted instead, and two vets ended up getting killed. President Hoover now had 10,000 ex-military men on his front stoop. Things were escalating into a crisis completely out of the president's control, seemingly par for the course for his administration. Hoover sent in troops to clear out the veterans that same day. Backed up by Majors George S. Patton and Dwight Eisenhower, General Douglas MacArthur led a military contingent and carried out Hoover's orders successfully. But the idea of literally sending in the tanks against hungry American veterans was a complete public relations disaster. Throughout the 1932 presidential race, FDR successfully blamed President Hoover for indifference to the ongoing depression, while also attacking him for his massive spending hikes, which he would manage to outdo several times over when he became president himself. The campaign against Hoover got so bad that the president received a telegram from some smart aleck advising him to vote for Roosevelt and make it unanimous. Though the vote that November was not quite unanimous, the 1932 election was still as drastic a reversal of the previous vote as could be expected. In 1928, Hoover had taken 40 states, and now FDR snagged 42, dropping Hoover's percentage of the popular vote from a landslide 58% to a mere 40%. The Senate elections were a similar bloodbath, with FDR's Democrats winning 28 out of 34 races and defeating Republican leader James Watson in the process. The Democrats picked up almost 100 seats in the House of Representatives, giving them a lead of close to 3-1 and a record number of seats. FDR's first 100 days in the White House were a massive leftward tilt in American governance, with the machinery of government moving at an unprecedented pace. Everything seemed to be on the table in terms of policy. It was very clear that this was a historic opportunity to remake the relationship between the private sphere and the public one. These were unprecedented times, and one lifelong leftist was inspired to try and do something about it. Upton Sinclair remains the classic example of those journalist activists then known as muckrakers, a more polite way of saying shit stirrers. His novel, The Jungle, is still assigned in high school classes over a century after its publication. Decades before his book, the expression, "Laws are like sausages, it's better not to see them being made," was an idiom based on the less than pleasant culinary process. It was Sinclair who showed Americans how the sausage literally got made. Ostensibly fiction, The Jungle claimed to portray, among other things, the unsanitary conditions in meatpacking factories. The apex of Sinclair's gruesome prose came with a worker falling into a vat and being rendered into lard for sale to the general public. They couldn't believe it's not butter. After being serialized in a socialist newspaper the year prior, The Jungle was first published in book form in February 1906. President Teddy Roosevelt had been a harsh skeptic of the young Sinclair, but the novel worked its magic on the president as it did on so many others. By June 30, Roosevelt was signing into law the Federal Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act, creating what would eventually become today's enormously influential Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. Sinclair was only 27 years old, and already his writing was changing the face of America. He was an influencer over a century before the term achieved its contemporary connotations. Sinclair's stated purpose in writing The Jungle had been to spread the message of socialism to the American people. Instead, the federal government became a guarantor of the quality of products of private industry at public cost. Rather than the state operating the factories, the capitalists continued to produce their meat unabated. Despite the author's best efforts, his book did not whet the population's appetite for a socialist takeover of the meat industry. As Sinclair put it, "I aimed at the public's heart, and by accident, I hit it in the stomach." To this day, largely due to Sinclair, it is regarded as an uncontroversial truth that the government is the best and only agency with the capacity to certify the safety of food. The alternative would obviously be mass death and illness. Like virtually all other socialists at the time, Sinclair was somewhat critical of, but not entirely opposed to, communism. Hungry for political power and eager to spread his ideology, Sinclair ran for the House of Representatives in 1920 and for the United States Senate in 1922 under the banner of the Socialist Party. When both those failed, he tried to run for California governor in 1926 and again in 1930, earning roughly 4% of the vote each time. But all that was before FDR's landslide. 50% of the people are going to vote a certain ticket because their grandfather voted that ticket, Sinclair realized. In order to get anywhere, it is necessary to have a party which has grandfathers. The author activist accordingly tossed his hat into the ring as a Democrat for the 1934 California gubernatorial election. Despite having no political experience and no affiliation with the Democratic Party for decades, Sinclair easily clinched the nomination. All that stood between him and the governor's office was hapless Republican Governor Frank Merriam, who had only assumed office in June upon the death of his predecessor. Sinclair's plan for California was bold, and it was radical. His promise to end poverty in California, epic, was based on a few principles, namely, private ownership of tools, a basis of freedom when tools are simple, becomes a basis of enslavement when tools are complex. Autocracy in industry cannot exist alongside democracy in government. The existence of luxury in the presence of poverty and destitution is contrary to good morals and sound public policy. The present depression is one of abundance, not scarcity. The cause of the trouble is that a small class has the wealth, while the rest have the debts. The remedy is to give the workers access to the means of production and let them produce for themselves, not for others. In short, the largest part of his epic plan was for the government to take over idle lands or factories and put the unemployed to work on them. Reporters had some very obvious questions for Sinclair, namely, suppose your plan goes into effect, won't it cause a great many unemployed to come to California from other states? Sinclair's response did more harm than good. As he put it, "I told Mr. Hopkins, the Federal Relief Administrator, that if I'm elected, half the unemployed of the United States will come to California and he'll have to make plans to take care of them. I went on to discuss this subject. Of course, I said I was making Mr. Hopkins a sales talk, but he recognizes the situation. The unemployed come to California every fall because it is less easy to freeze to death here. The federal government is taking care of them where they are, and it will have to take care of them in California. Mr. Hopkins knows that. Someone asked if there was any way they could be kept out of California, and I said the only way was to keep the people of California so poor that those in other states would not envy their condition. In fact, they have to be kept a little poorer because California is a pleasanter place to live in. Such was the program actually favored by our big business masters," I added. Now the question became whether FDR would endorse Sinclair and his leftist ideas, or if he would try and remain out of the fray. A Democrat hadn't been elected California governor in 40 years, but FDR had carried the state 58% to 38% over Hoover 4 years after Hoover had won it, 65% to 34%. Clearly, the possibility of a Governor Sinclair was very real. After vacillating for a while, FDR finally agreed to meet with Sinclair. On September 4, 1934, Sinclair made his way to the president's upstate New York estate at Hyde Park for a conversation that, by all accounts, Collins was highly amiable. In his typical reptilian fashion, FDR made sure that Sinclair left the meeting with the belief that the president agreed with him and would come out publicly against the very concept of profit. Roosevelt told Sinclair that he intended to give a speech on or around October 25th, right before the election, advocating Sinclair's preferred production for use as against production for profit. "If you will do that, Mr. President," Sinclair said, "it will elect me." FDR, of course, intended nothing of the kind. It only took him 5 days before he was throwing Sinclair under the bus, but doing so off the record to reporters so that the gubernatorial candidate was none the wiser. Not only calling the scale of Sinclair's epic plan utterly impossible, FDR went on to paint Sinclair as a fanatic. "If Sinclair has any sense in him," the president said, "he will modify, at least in practice, this perfectly wild-eyed scheme of his and carry it on as a community experiment." It was on October 24th, not the 25th, that Roosevelt did in fact give a speech. He told a group of bankers that America has what we call and accept as a profit system. Rather than endorsing Sinclair's socialist vision, Roosevelt reiterated his view of free enterprise as the basis of the American economy. On Election Day a couple weeks later, Democrats won 25 out of 34 gubernatorial races. Two others were won by third-party candidates, and just 7 won by Republicans, including California. The progressive candidate in the election won 13% of the vote in a race that Democratic nominee Upton Sinclair lost by 11%. Sinclair did not take it well and later claimed that his supporters were even more devastated. "Men and women broke down and wept when the certainty of our defeat became apparent. I know of women who cried the whole night through, and doubtless there were thousands. I know of one suicide and at least one other attempt." EPIC continued as a movement, and Roosevelt shamelessly adopted some of Sinclair's ideas as he further built up the New Deal in his attempts to battle America's ongoing Great Depression. 4 years later, Sinclair engaged in a public exchange of letters with the aforementioned journalist Eugene Lyons. Lyons had been a young communist sent to Russia under the auspices of the United Press in hopes that his ideological sympathy with the Bolsheviks would earn him greater access. The gamble paid off. At only 32 years of age and 3 years before Walter Duranty, Lyons became the first Western journalist to interview Stalin. This increased access also meant increased information and, just as with Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, Lyons became a harsh critic of the USSR after seeing with his own eyes what the Bolshevik experiment meant in practice. The debate between Sinclair and Lyons was a perfect stand-in for the broader cultural debate in the West as to what one's relationship to the Soviet Union should be, especially in the face of increasing German belligerence. Yes, Sinclair was a socialist, but he was a democratic socialist. "I have been tireless in my insistence upon majority consent," he wrote, "and in my rejection of every suggestion of violence and dictatorship in bringing about social change." A champion of the working man, he resented being accused of things he did not identify as in the slightest. "Having been a socialist for 32 years and having set forth my ideas in a score of books and hundreds of magazine articles, I really thought I was safe from being called a communist." At the same time, he made clear that when I criticize what Russia is doing, I criticize it as a friend who understands. The exchange of letters between Lyons and Sinclair was collected under the title Terror in Russia. The question mark was no doubt Sinclair's, as Lyons knew for a fact what was happening in the Soviet Union. To his dubious credit, Sinclair did not shy away from acknowledging and justifying Stalin's brutality. "I read not long ago of an American diplomat who had traveled over Europe, including Russia. He said, 'It is a fact that the Russians have never learned to govern without killing.' That was an unkind saying, but if it is true, it is something we have to take account of. We do not kill our political opponents, at least not often, but in Russia, it is a custom of long standing." There is something uniquely bizarre about hearing Upton Sinclair, one of the most popular and influential radicals in American history, rationalizing mass murder on the basis of tradition. In words that would sound chilling within a decade, Sinclair's view of the mass Ukrainian starvation was that, "I venture to doubt that 5 million were permitted to die." Permitted is one of those words that have different meanings. At the very least, Sinclair was claiming that the Soviet government wouldn't allow such a thing to happen without acting to prevent it. That Stalin was in fact responsible for those deaths didn't even enter Sinclair's thought as a consideration. "My guess," Sinclair continued, "is that it is nearer to 1 million, but that was enough." What basis Sinclair had for this admitted guess, he never says. But what's a few million lives here or there? The system of socialized industry and collectivized agriculture, Sinclair summed up, is one which has proved so disturbingly successful in the Soviet Union. He was right. The elements of Stalin's collectivized agriculture which were most successful, the unremitting demand for grain which starved millions, were also the most disturbing. Again and again, Sinclair excused away any and all aspects of mass coercion. "The Russians did it by force because that is the only way that anything has ever been done in Russia. The principle of the revolution was to create a new society, as Sinclair knew well. But once again, a tradition of violence was an explanation, if not a downright excuse. Then Sinclair made quite a bold prediction. Unless the fascists succeed in defeating the Soviet Union in the war they are planning and taking away the Ukraine and other grain-producing land, no more people need die of hunger in the Soviet Union. At least that is my belief. The million or 5 million lives which were sacrificed will mean the savings of hundreds of millions of lives in future times. In this, Sinclair was technically correct. Once Stalin's government ran out of people that he wanted to starve, he did in fact stop starving them. But what was even more disturbing was the hand-waving away of millions of real flesh and blood people for the sake of some imaginary future hypothetical. There has never been in human history a great social change without killing, Sinclair dishonestly claimed. Our civil war cost 1 million lives and $5 billion. If anyone argues that Lincoln and Grant were mass murderers, the only way you could answer is to point out the gains in the preservation of the Union and the ending of chattel slavery. The comparison between lives lost in warfare and lives lost due to oppression by the government seemed to be lost on Sinclair, as is the fact that the civil war led to freeing the enslaved while Stalin had done everything in his power to crush the Ukrainian population. At the very least, there was the tacit admission that there had been a war waged against the farmers, who were supposedly the same people Sinclair had championed his entire life. The man who saw firsthand how duplicitous politicians could be had no qualm about taking Stalin's propaganda at face value. For Sinclair and many others of his stripe, the enormously lagging economy, no one was ending poverty in Russia anytime soon, was all the fault of wreckers who deserved whatever they got. Despite its decades-old secret police, the Soviet Union was somehow overrun with both Nazi and Japanese agents. According to Sinclair, questioning Stalin's claims wasn't an exercise in prudence so much as one in absurdity. That Germany and Poland, Romania and Japan have been filling the Soviet Union with spies and provocateurs is something which no sensible person would doubt for a moment, he proclaimed. If such persons were sent into this country and committed wholesale wrecking of machinery and destruction of human life, we would shoot them, and no doubt other nations which were getting ready to make war on us would denounce it as a terrible and barbarous action. Those who questioned Stalin's executions were the ones acting in bad faith and simply trying to weaken Soviet power. After all, Americans also shoot people who break machinery. Sinclair also regarded as absurd the concept that the Russian people faced heavy literary censorship. Replying to Lyons, he wrote, "You doubt the benefits of Soviet education, saying that only words written by the ruling clique may be read." Will you really defend such a statement, or is it merely a bit of rhetoric? And how did Sinclair know that Russian citizens had access to whatever they would like to read? He knew, because more than 3 million of my books have been translated and published in Russia. Sinclair could not disprove that there was complete government control of political discourse within the USSR, so he instead just sort of denied it. In response to the accusation that all these persons are entirely enslaved, he simply declared that, "I'm unable to believe this, and I think that if the ruling group in Russia has committed a betrayal of the basic principles of socialism, workers' democracy, the educated workers will find it out in the course of time and will find a way to get that which has been so elaborately planned to them for the past 20 years. How they would find such things out and how they would learn such things from a state which starved millions of its own citizens, Sinclair didn't even bother to hypothesize." Finally, Sinclair defended the mass executions of Stalin's political opponents, or rather those who were alleged to have been his opponents. "As to the left-wing extremists who have been trying to hamper Stalin by sabotage and underground civil war, I've been shocked and cried by their fate, but..." There was always a but. Sinclair ignored that sabotage and underground civil war in the Soviet Union had come to be defined simply as disagreeing with Stalin, insisting that when they started the war on Stalin, they did so at their own risk and perfectly well knowing it. If the medicine they had to swallow is bitter, the answer is that it is their own medicine, which they have been brewing and administering throughout their political careers. Once again, drawing parallels between Stalin and the Founding Fathers, both were revolutionaries after all, Sinclair points out that we hanged Major Andre, and you could hardly doubt that we should have hanged Benedict Arnold if we had been able to catch him. In regard to the obviously phony trials, Sinclair claimed to have taken a balanced view. "Over and over I asked myself, is it conceivable that revolutionists trained in a lifetime of war against the Tsar would go into open court and confess to actions which they had not committed? I asked, is there any torture, any kind of terror, physical, mental, or moral, which would induce them to such a thing?" Rhetorical questions are perhaps of use rhetorically, but they do not affect reality in the slightest. If an individual cannot conceive of an answer to a question, that does not mean or even imply that the answer is inconceivable. It could simply mean that his knowledge or imagination is limited. The man who wrote of greedy capitalists selling sausages made of human meat found it impossible that men, even men trained in a lifetime of war, could be tortured to such a degree that they would make false confessions, even if they were confessing to things which were demonstrably false and literally impossible. The greater the atrocity, the more people would like to believe, or possibly even need to believe, that the reports were surely an exaggeration. It would clearly be preferable if none of Stalin's innocent victims had been tortured. If denial was not an option, then bargaining comes in. Let's haggle and hope for half the number claimed, and that the tortures that were alleged were exaggerated in the manner of some trashy story in a forgotten pulp magazine. The Stalin epic is replete with what appear as improbabilities to minds unfitted to deal with the phenomena, wrote Conquest. Similarly, with the argument that Stalin could not have killed millions of peasants, since that would have been economically